absorb some local color through the magic of AM radio.
The Book of Revelations tells us to watch for the seven signs of evil.
Wait, sign of evil number 4.
We're continuing our sign of evil countdown. Here's Vanessa Williams.
This is 90.7 FM WGXC Accra, Hudson, Catskill, the station that everyone loves.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Basilica Hudson's Farm and Flea Spring Market. Open on Mother's Day weekend, May 10th and 11th. Festival goers can play, learn, eat, and shop from 100 local farms, chefs, makers, and collectors, celebrating the natural bounty of the Hudson Valley. Information at basilicahudson.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Heidi Nielsen of Gilboa, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the Thingularity Radio program, coming to you live, actually on location this time, broadcasting from the treehouse. With me tonight, I have several different people that are not normal. They are tuning in from across the internet and across the phone lines, and some are hiding in the corners. And then we also have the traditional crew here. Brian, how you doing?
Nagging myself.
Just shout it out. He's doing all right. Yep. He's doing the magic. He's so good. Cody, how you doing?
Hey, doing okay. Doing okay.
All right. It's a beautiful day, guys.
Absolutely.
Mac, how are you?
I second that sentiment. Yeah, pretty good.
Awesome. And Greg, to my immediate right, how are you?
I'm great. I'm honored to be here for this.
Thank you. We appreciate it very much. And can you tell me what the treehouse is?
So I met Tom Ditto through my friend Rudy Burkhout, who is a holographer that I knew since the 80s. And Rudy passed away. He built a house here, and we wound up buying the house and met Tom. And, you know, we hit it off immediately. Tom is one of the most brilliant people I've met. And this was sort of his sanctuary, and the first time I came on Thingularity, he said to me, oh, we got to do it up at your house, at the treehouse. And I said, well, isn't that a lot of work to move the radio show up there? And he said, no, those guys that just have a suitcase, they'll bring it up, no problem. And so here we are in honor of Tom Ditto, his favorite sanctuary.
It is a beautiful day. We're sitting here in a wonderful living room with beautiful glass doors that are showing us Sunset on the mountains.
Excellent view of the Catskill Mountains.
Yes, absolutely. Be jealous.
Majestic. Yep.
We have Phil in, who's phoned in, and I believe is patched in completely.
I am.
Phil, how you doing?
I'm present and accounted for, and also completely honored to be here in remembrance of Tom.
Very glad to have you. Would you like to say anything? Get us kicked off here?
Oh, so I don't know whether to see, this is about starting at the beginning or sort of jumping in and going to the end or all the points in between. I don't know if we, you know, I guess there's a picture of Tom that will sort of evolve here. You know, Tom the scientist, Tom, you know, a tremendous friend. I mean, a collaborator, an amazing creative spirit. He was into color. He was into light. You know, I guess I first met him. He was making films. And then he said, well, we're going to do animation using synthesizers. In the early 70s, I guess, that was my introduction to Tom. And it was kind of a wonderful, lifelong friendship. You know, it was just an incredibly rich experience. You know, he was one of my closest and dearest friends, and I learned so much from him, and he was so challenging in so many ways. Just a wonderful character. That's yeah, awesome. And there's stories I hope to come out here decade over decade with the escapades with Tom. Does anybody remember the Fool Bus?
The what?
The Fool Bus?
The Fool Bus. It was the Ford Fairlane that Tom was, I think he was living in it at various points and driving it around. It had a whole thing was sculpted with foam.
We are not privy to this. He didn't tell us about this one.
The Fool Bus brunch.
So what year was this?
Yeah, what year?
Can I tell you the decade? I mean, it was like somewhere in the
70s. Yeah, that's fine.
Or the century.
Any shady, foggy reference is perfectly fine.
It was back, you know, the old saying is, if you remembered it, you weren't there.
So, I'm going to remember that one.
It was said about the 60s, I guess. So the I met Tom kind of in my early 20s, and up until his passing, he was just, you know, a never-ending source of joy and delight and creativity and, you know, wonder and arguments and agreements. You know, I don't know if there's a place to start with Tom. I think you just sort of keep running, you know, you just keep running. I guess so, to put kind of a starting point and an end point to it, we had plans for doing an installation of some things in this gallery in North Adams in August. And, you know, I had some travels in February, and I said I'd get back in touch with him when you sort of start putting those plans together. It has something to do with, I think the latest plan was some combination of Shakespeare's soliloquies, a CO2-filled weather balloon that was going to act as an acoustics lens that also was going to act kind of, it's in the Eclipse Gallery, so there's a whole astronomical thing also that we're going to sort of pile in here. And he had this thing about, well, what we should do is, you know, do this focused sound thing, which is kind of one of the areas that I delved into a lot. And you know, his passion was wave theory and light, and mine was similar things and sound. So we would talk a lot about the science of waves, and he was much better with particles than I was. But yeah. So there's also this thing that he was into about, we'll have to do something with these these 3D chroma glasses. And I'm still trying to puzzle out how what he had in mind on that one. But this, I think there's a way. I think he left enough breadcrumbs to sort of, you know, his spirit and his ghost is going to drive me forward on a lot of these things. So, yeah, there's going to be another Remembrance of Tom, and I think we'll do a kind of retrospective of creative work and try to show some of the inventions in this gallery in North Adams in August, you know. So, yeah, but there's others in the rooms that should also sort of get a chance to introduce themselves, sort of fill in some blanks.
Hmm. North Adams, oh, all the other things, yeah, the science, the art, the everything.
And community, right?
Family. And the community, yeah.
No, that was the, I mean, I think to a certain extent, you know, I'm a firm believer in community radio and what a good way to, you know, I think this is what Singularity is about as near as I can tell.
So, yeah.
And then we could talk about Tom's video studio at WRPI, the radio station at RPI, in the pre-impact days.
In the mid-70s, the video experimentation?
That was a little bit probably late 70s, early 80s.
Okay,
when
okay.
He moved the video synthesis studio over to Troy, yeah.
Okay.
That was pretty neat.
It seems like he was pretty natural at Singularity, and that's probably why.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, no. This was so you have to sort of fill me in on, you know, how he came to Singularity.
How he came to the syndicate.
He just kind of wandered in one day.
He wandered in the front door.
He wandered in on a random Tech Tuesday.
And then we started talking, actually. He was talking about – he actually did his little 90-second whatever at first. But, you know, with Tom, 90 seconds was just the beginning of it. But we had discovered – like within the first minute that we had, even though I am a decade or two or more younger, that we had met some of the same people in the late 70s, early 80s. He was a protege of Ed Emshwiller, and I actually met that guy when I was a kid in the late 70s. So he was like, "What? You met him?" Yeah. Over.
So there's extraordinary intersections.
Yes.
You know, Tom. Tom, I knew Ed Emshwiller's work from, you know, this residency at WNET TV Lab. This must have been 74, 75, 76. And, you know, there is the combinations of people. So, yeah, they're his mentors, the people that inspired him, and he that really, he was such a unique mind, it's sort of hard to know that, you know, he inspired himself to a certain extent, but he certainly was very conscious of the influence of, you know, his collaborators and his, you know, people that came before him. It's great, you know, in the snippets I've seen of his autobiography, and then you look around on the web, and he had this incredible inquisitive mind and love, you know, how to combine things together and acts of discovery and what you can do with science and, you know, the what you could do with color, what you could do with light.
Tracking the really subtle changes of video art by like the little strokes and differences. That's what I noticed about that one chapter from the late 70s, early 80s. He was going on about the different things and the quality of light, color and whatnot and motion.
All I could think of is the color changes that he would apply to the astronomical recordings that he was planning for the satellites and ground-based telescopes.
Mm-hmm. Ground-based and...
His whole thing was separating out different components of what you were seeing by color instead of just, you know, looking at it as standard visual wavelengths. He wanted that to be data.
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome.
One of my favorite Tom stories is his demonstration of this the patent he got on diffraction through rangefinding, and he basically was looking at a point of light, you know, in a CD, and looking at the rainbow you get from a CD.
Oh
and
yeah.
His discovery was that the farther the point was that you're sort of casting the light on from the diffraction grating, from the CD, right, the shiny side of the CD, the distance of the rainbow was proportional. And that, he understood the math of that, got the patent for it, and right. Essentially that was, I think, his first published scientific work, you know, this, and he had this interest in 3D imaging, you know, all along.
That ring thing he kept trying to get working at the Makers.
That's what I found so funny. That, like, the biggest cosmic joke to me is that he got a patent on, like, a quality of photons and physics, which is kind of like having a claim to steal the moon, you know. It's just
it's like, it's a weird abstract.
I got a patent on weight. What? No, you can't do that. But that's like, his patent was in that range of something so common and universal. And yet there was a patent on
that particular thing becomes crucial to somebody else.
Exactly.
Endeavor, and then it just makes them tons of money.
Yeah, and that becomes the prior art that something else is based on.
Yeah. Well, one of his videos that have sort of come at least my way in the last couple of days was about, you know, building on the shoulders of giants. And he sort of pulled a quote from Isaac, I think it was an Isaac Newton quote, you know. I guess we'll have to sort of find a way of distributing to the radio audience here some of the URLs and the links, you know, to look at some, to see some of his work, kind of his follow-up and homework. You know, but he understood the historical basis.
We can post that stuff in the show's description. So if you head to the website, wgxz.org, as you're hearing this, you should be able to find it.
Oh, great.
Except for the live show.
I don't know if that I can.
Yeah, right.
You know, so the other thing that completely amazed me, and mostly later, was that he had the sense of the historical basis and the continuity that he was sort of following in, and yet on the on his creative work and the video, there wasn't any much precedent. Maybe the Whitney brothers a little bit, M. Schwiller, Vanderbeek, you know, that was the you know. And the other thing that Bev forwarded that was absolutely wonderful was his first film from 1964. It was just. That one was a great one as well.
I missed that. What was on that? Was it a black and white film? What was the?
It was a black and white film. Oh God, this is the problem when you get old. Your memory. You know, I knew it yesterday.
It was yesterday. I don't remember.
Well, you know,
what's this in my mouth? Oh, I'm eating. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last year with Bad Marion.
Bev's refusing to be on a mic. Like, literally across the room.
We are happy translate.
It's okay.
Oh, Lord. I had a question for you. Now, this goes back to... Now, this is a funny thing. Like, for years, Tom was telling me about, we invented motion capture. This and, you know, today it's like a whole 3D process with... you know, stereo cameras and whatnot, but you guys were there in 74, 75, 76 doing the first, literally inventing it, right? But I tried to get a description about him, like, how did it work? And he would start giving me a description, then he would Tom out and go in to start talking about God and your relationship. You know, he goes like, what are you talking about? And he'd go into his Tom thing, and the stories would go everywhere, and you'd be talking about Shakespeare soon. And then I met you a few years ago, and I said, Phil, how did that work? And I swear in 60 seconds you explained to me technically. I was like, oh, I get it. But you were the coder for that. He was like the dreamer, the visionaire, but you coded it on some old PDP, what? PDP?
A PDP 8L.
8L. So that's a what? Is that the 200-pound computer or the 1,200-pound one?
It wasn't anything less than, you know, maybe 120. So this was...
without the power supply.
This was in the time before personal computers. And, oh, God. So I had learned programming in high school, and I was always interested in electronics, and always as a kid sort of doing strange things about magnets and motors and sounds and light and you know, I get to this high school and they had, IBM gave them a computer, and I kind of figured out, and I get to Albany, and where I was an undergraduate, and someone gave me this, the third computer on campus, which was the same generation as that PDP-8.
Third computer ever on campus?
I think, so the first computer was...
Just being clear.
The second one was in the linear accelerator. The third one was in the audiology lab.
Okay.
And I think, maybe I'll exaggerate a little bit, tall tale, but I think the fourth one was the one I put into the electronic music studio and then in the performing arts center there. So this is, and now all of things are completely commodities, you know, and it was not even radical then. It was just, you know, we were, Tom would say ahead of our time, but we were just sort of, you know, in a time by ourselves. It was just wonderful. So
that was all upstate.
Yeah, it was just Albany. This is
Albany.
Tom's come back from the West Coast, you know, with a couple of these animation films on and off in fall, you know, that he had this idea that he was looking for essentially doing these, you know, electronic image generation using analog synthesizers. And kind of we befriended there. I was kind of the tech guy in the studio and kind of an aspiring, soon to become an aspiring composer. Tom invites me down to the WNETV lab, I guess it was on 47th Street, where he was an artist in residence along with M. Schwiller and M. June Pike. And I guess Van de Beek was there. There's a Merce Cunningham did some dance films there. Wonderful scene, but very, very brief. Part of the soup of that was a Pike Ave synthesizer, a Red Etra synthesizer.
Red Etra, video synthesizer.
Red Etra video synthesizer. The TV lab sort of was defunded, and they sort of took all the esoteric stuff that the video artists were using and, you know, dispersed of it. Tom was able to obtain, I think, through one of the grants that he got, one of the creativity grants, the PDP-8. We haul it up to Albany, and Tom says, well, let's see if we can figure out how to track a dot. And if you can do that, then you can use, and my interest then was to use it as a that tracking device for controlling sound. And he was using it as a device for animation and film. The idea was very, very simple. Is essentially if you can isolate a single dot in a frame, like a flashlight held in a frame, and if you can measure the XY position of it and track that, you know, you can then have interactive images. So this was the infancy before computer graphics, by the way. I mean, this is more contemporaneous with that. And, you know, sort of like, oh, I knew enough electronics, and we could store one point for each scan line of the video in the memory of the computer and essentially read that out a couple of different ways. So we wired up, you know, a bunch of transistor logic, these first generation integrated circuits, to the backplane of the PDP-8, and essentially lo and behold, we were able to, when working with a bunch of dancers and a choreographer, Maud Baum at Electronic Body Arts, sort of had this wonderful little experimental device up and running probably by 1974, 75.
And so they'd move around, and any dot they had, that you would track a graphic on top of it, right?
It started out, I think, with like a tennis ball, you know, and then so the first generation was not even, it was just really for each, can I identify where this glowing dot is? And again, the derivation of this was from the tracking pins from radar going back into the 50s. You know, so the first generation of light pens in computer graphics was an idea, right? So it was essentially instead of, you know, on a track pad, which was the first generation from the 50s, we were doing it using a camera as the sensor. And then, you know, a very simple idea is you then start, you know, counting. I think we actually, and it was a little bit technical, using essentially, I think, the 358 megahertz clock.
The bandwidth clock of the video signal.
Yeah, essentially to count up, and then when you saw the light in the frame, something called the keying, right?
Just yeah, linear transition.
You read the counter, put it in the memory of the computer, went and looked when it was in the next line, and you could then derive, you know, very quickly. I think we were getting like 100 points of resolution, and
wow,
you could track the motion, you know, human motion. So, and Tom, of course, with his background in photography and film, you know, it's like the original Muybridge studies, motion studies to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So that was Pantomation. I go off and actually take a job for Digital Equipment Corporation. My whole life, I sort of switched between, you know, corporate software development kind of things in the creative world.
Yeah.
Sometimes better than others. So I go off and take, and then Tom goes and ports Pantomation to an Apple IIe. So now we're finally in the PC age, if you will, and essentially uses a Hearn synthesizer and the chroma keyer in this Hearn synthesizer to essentially track multiple colors on the frame, and you get a little bit more resolution.
You had to be stressing tracking. Out that hardware.
Was it Apple IIe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Its hair had to be on.
It was just like
the digital
data capture or analog data capture, right?
A to D. It's just foundational stuff.
Yeah.
It's the and it was always like use what's available. So one of the, and I was very nuts and bolts about it to a certain sense. Like, okay, Tom, I understand what we're trying to do, and I know technically how to do it, so let's do it.
Yeah. So you had to lock him down.
Well, I mean, it was just, I don't know which one of us was kind of worse in certain respects.
So you're saying it was like a cat herding a cat.
So you're just chasing each other's tails.
That's funny. There must have been some really funny freaking conversations in the development process.
Well, that's good. Like all that stuff, you nerds out there in Radio Land better have a little bit of respect for. Just saying.
There was a time on Earth when there was like 50 people doing this. Not 50 million or 500 million people.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty... it's Tom's brilliance. I mean, and how supportive he was personally to me also. I mean, I was kind of feral in those days. Maybe I'm a little bit better, but I don't know. And he really kind of nurtured me, and he really was like, yeah, you know, it's like you have to do what, you know, there is a whole, you know, he was a mentor to a certain extent, and like all mentors, you then depart from them to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But the friendship was always there very intensely, you know, and it was just a delight to stay connected all the years, you know, what's almost more important for Radioland was how wonderful a friend Tom was, you know.
Yeah.
He may have been this creative genius, but over the decades, for every phase of my life, he was a true, true friend. And that's kind of amazing. You know, that was
And during the shows, he was always spot on with the timing. And right about now is when he would shake his hand and wave at me so I can remind all of you, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Hudson, and Catskill. Sorry, needed a good time for that.
Let's hear from some of the others about how and when they met Tom, also kind of some of their experiences.
My experience is arguing with him constantly on the radio show. just children. Now, I will give him this. He had a habit for monologuing, shall we say, that he got under control, like, as time went by. Like, he knew, like, how to, like, he learned how to focus and just keep the group going instead of just kind of wandering off mentally. It was pretty good. But yeah, he was the one that would give me the most guff for my ideas, and I appreciated it deeply.
Well, and my perspective, what Thingularity is about, and Phil, you've been in the corporate world for half your life and the deep art world for the other half.
I smelled the alcohol when you walked by.
Be quiet.
That's just, well, this and is that about reminds me, folks, if you head on over to WGXE.org, you hit that listen button in the upper left corner, there will be a pop-up tab at the bottom. You'll see the Thingularity stream playing. If you go there now, you can keep listening to us right through the break, which turns into another show on WGXE. But in our digital space, it turns into the after show, which becomes FCC-free.
Yeah. So what I was saying, like in the corporate world, you know that one of the most important things you have there is your weekly or your monthly meeting, and it's like the oldest ritual for man. It's either going to be make you love your job and you love your team, or you're just going to hate it.
It's hate. It's always hate.
And so that's what Thingularity is. It's our monthly thing where the nerds who are, like I say, 3 to 10 steps above that canyon, like Wile E. Coyote hanging there in the Asperger chasm, the autism chasm, we're just floating. And once a month we come together and we feel actually human because we're like, oh yeah, like we exist in this world.
It's not just me.
So this is our.
We're not alone, and folks, you guys out there aren't alone either.
This is
especially
our.
Especially if you're still listening to us.
Aspie gathering around the imaginary fire to go, oh yes, we are here.
Well, we work on electronics. Sometimes the fire isn't imaginary.
That was kind of my first meeting with Tom. He came in with the box.
The beepy box?
Yeah, no, not the beepy box.
The boopy box?
The refraction grating box.
Oh, the ring. The ring.
The ring thing.
Yeah, the ring mouse.
And he's all like, I need to do CV. What do you guys know about Python?
Right. And what he needed was somebody. Yeah.
That's good.
You know, we should explain to the radio audience what the ring is. Right?
Oh man, I'm sure they've heard it so many times. But the ring, the 3D ring, was using that aspect about diffraction gratings and the distance
color
between
separation.
a point source of light and that diffraction grating, the difference in the spectral lines. The idea was to use that principle to track the position of a ring in space.
3D space. As you move it around inside a room, this camera would track your position. And, of course, it would use beautiful, beautiful colors to do so.
That's right.
But that was Tom's thing.
So it was rigged up with a Raspberry Pi. And, well, Tom was, you know, he was very creative and
we just couldn't figure out.
More of a visionary, but when it came to actually getting into, like, you know, the terminal and messing around with Linux.
Nuts and the bolts.
You know, that's where we came in.
We just couldn't.
That's where Cody came in. Tom's like, Cody, I broke it again. Fix it. He's fixing it. I did that to Cody once. Remember when we were doing some art thing over at Riedelbauer's? And my brain broke one day. I was sitting there with a keyboard.
Michael Jackson's.
It just totally
broke.
Moonwalker. Right. I looked at Cody. Could you do this? I don't know what I'm doing now.
I remember that. You guys set that up. Chris and I had to go there and fix it that night or something.
So can we get Bev to tell us how she met Tom?
Please. Come up to the mic.
Will you come over and tell us?
Bring your drink over here, Bev.
Phil says. Flip says. That was his nickname for you, right? Flip?
Yep.
He claims it was from a character from Tintin. Was that true?
I believe it was.
Okay.
Oh. I believe it was. Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure about that story.
We're bringing on a Bev Ditto.
So there's something about Bev and Tom in the light shows. Really?
Yes. My ex-boyfriend was involved in this. But I was going with a person at the time who also knew Tom, and we were doing light shows together. So basically it was the three of us doing light shows together, and then my ex exited, and I saw Tom and said, well, this is an interesting person, and got to know him a little better, definitely. So it was, yes, it was through the light shows that we did, definitely, and I really enjoyed doing the laser light shows. It was something I really enjoyed doing. I mean, I come from an art background and painting and airbrushing. And so the light shows were kind of, you know, more tech. And but it was also a very creative, wonderful outlet that we enjoyed together. So
this is, you know, lasers and galvanometer mirrors and circuits wiggling the mirrors and liquids, right?
Open the door.
Yep.
I'll just break the barrier.
Yeah, we did some very nice shows, you know. One of them was in Albany on the City Hall at night. And that was for a first night presentation. And, you know, we did some amazing parties and things and a lot of planetarium shows. Mm. So it was definitely a fun party time. And, you know, Tom had his vision, which did not agree with my ex in terms of the type of music. And Tom was very much into Happy Roads and some of the other kind of music like that. And, of course, most light shows are rock and roll,
yeah.
hard rock and roll. And so he kind of wanted to move away from that. And
really?
That was okay, you know, for certain venues, but not for all venues. So, you know, a lot of just wanted the rock and roll that they know and love. So they kind of parted ways, and that is right around the same time as I parted ways with my ex. So we went off to do other things.
You know what he talked? One thing he talked about that he, you know, gave a good impression of you was that once you guys had stopped doing that, I think you guys would sort of travel around and you would paint these beautiful artistic renderings of like exoplanets and other astronomical bodies.
Yes. So my background was in astronomy. I minored in astronomy and majored in art. So not only did I do the light shows, but which was kind of a secondary thing, mm-hmm. but my main focus was the art and astronomy art. And so that is kind of how we connected as well. And I would drag him around to all the astronomy functions. You know, get up early. We got to get up early and we got to, you know, sell those T-shirts. And because I did T-shirts and ties. And so it was, he got to know the astronomy crowd through me.
So you were the gateway drug to the whole astronomy thing.
Yes.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Today I learned.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Wow. Okay.
So, yep, he started going after astronomy in the way that he could, which was from the tech end of things, you know, not the artistic end,
yeah.
which I was
yeah.
doing.
The NSF grants and the telescopes and the
Yep, and that was just the whole start. Yeah, the whole, you know, got into the gold grants.
I believe that, like, a lot of the stuff that Tom was working on, you know, in the latter years of his life, we're going to be seeing that implemented in so many different things.
Yeah.
In, like, maybe not my lifetime, but
it's in the body of scientific research and some of
those
ideas.
Yeah, decide to fund NASA again. Yeah.
Something that Tom, his philosophy was always give it away for free kind of person. Mm-hmm. He was not, although he wanted to make money, we need money, we got to exist with money.
Sure.
But it wasn't his philosophy. He wanted it to just get out there, you know, his inventions, his ideas to be out there for people to use. And the Dittoscope was one such thing.
Yeah.
And he knew that he couldn't patent it. It wasn't something that he was going to patent. Mm. That he was going to make money off of it. There wasn't going to be a million ditto scopes made out there. But he just wanted it in the hands of, you know, the everyday person. Mm. So I had a bit of a hard time with that because, for me, observational astronomy, I mean, I went through the whole, I minored in astronomy, so I went through the whole regular astronomy regime, and I enjoyed looking through telescopes, and his was a very radically different telescope, so it wasn't really something, you know, that you're going to pull out and on the lawn and, you know, look.
It, processing. So,
but I kept encouraging him to go to the astronomy conventions, and Stellafane is one of the biggest ones in, up in Vermont. And it's an amazing place where tons of, you know, thousands of astronomers meet, amateur astronomers meet, and they applaud the sky. You know, they just sit up there applauding the sky when meteors go by. And, And
awesome.
It is awesome.
Sounds like
They have talks at these astronomy conferences. I always encouraged him to go to that, and he never did because he wanted it to be something, you know, like he could actually show, and he wanted it further along or something. I don't know. I could never get him to do that. But, yeah.
To just hang with the astronomers. You want to be in the lab just, doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so basically we didn't continue going to those events. And, of course, over time, the astronomy end of things with me, the painting and all that kind of slowed down because I had my son and was busy with that and busy with other life. And not to say that I still don't have a great interest in astronomy, but it's taken different paths for me, life. But
what's interesting to me is that you both are at a really interesting crossroads of art and science.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I always considered him a Renaissance man, you know, because he combined art and science. And not too many people can do that.
Right, right.
And I always saw, always felt that art and science belonged together. It was, I could see why, you know, art and science should be together. But a lot of people are like, oh, you're a scientist, or oh, you're an artist, but, you know, they don't.
That's him. That's him. He needs it to be separate. Mr. Rejecting of the concept.
How do you actually come up with hypotheses about how the about how the natural world works, except by being a little bit, you know, creative, having that artistic spark about
you keep
ideas.
That creativity to your hypotheses. You put it on paper. Kidding me?
That's how you get to a theory.
But where do the really intense and great ideas come from? Out of the ether. It's like, not even
well,
me.
Well, it's the creative person. Yes, it is the creative
who
person.
Who channels that thing out of the ether?
And it is hard.
Observation.
But some of the observation sometimes is like intuitive thing where it's just flying out of your gut or right through your head. You know what I mean? When you, the really fun ones.
Well, Einstein himself said that science is an aesthetic inquiry.
Yeah. Mm.
But, still, you got to keep your child in you. You have to keep the, you know, that inquisitive child throughout life.
That playfulness
and
thing.
Tom was always butting heads with your hardcore, you know, scientists who are schooled in a certain way. And, you know, they wouldn't see, they wouldn't think outside the box. They wouldn't see beyond what they've been taught.
I feel that.
So, you know, he would push. He'd always push.
Yeah.
He'd always push the envelope. And
absolutely.
That's the kind
of
person.
Yeah, he didn't tolerate the Muggles much.
The Muggles much? The Muggles, yeah.
I see that.
I remember this one time we were having a conversation on the radio, and he was describing how to make solar panels in the Sahara work without needing massive amounts of cooling. And I just wasn't getting it.
Well, a lot of people didn't get it. He was still pushing that right to the end.
But eventually I did get it after
The thing is, you reflect off all the stuff you don't need.
Exactly.
That's the only part that stuck with me. Because he was like, no,
You can make a material that reflects all the light except for in that little gap.
Solar cooling.
Solar cooling. That was his
thing.
That was his thing.
That would work, but then we'd have to move it in 7,000 years when the Sahara turned into a wetland. lens again.
Ah, no.
Bury it.
When the Earth wobbles back over to the other side, like it does every 10,000 years.
Wobbles?
Yeah, the wobble that turns the Sahara into a wetlands every 20,000 years.
What's that, Phil?
Can I ask Bev another people question? So, Bev, how did the connection with Heidi at RPI kind of happen? And that astronomy... Cool.
We went up to one of her talks at RPI, and I actually kind of went, I think it was one of the first ones, went down to talk to her first after the talk and got him going in her direction. But, you know, it was through the grants and stuff he got to know her. And actually, that's a good question for Heidi more, because I, you know, don't know of all the details of that, but... Yes, I do remember the very first meeting that we had with her. She was giving a talk at RPI, and we talked with her later afterwards. So that was our initial getting to know her. And she was very instrumental in helping further his ideas and, you know, do some work with him and get him help with grants and things like that, so... Yeah, she was here to talk.
Heidi.
Yeah. Heidi Jo Newberg.
Heidi Jo Newberg.
She's the director of the astronomy program.
One of the leads of one of the groups there.
She's a professor.
Think we can guilt her into coming down at some point?
Think we can guilt her, yes. You know, I think you can, sir. Sure.
Awesome.
Yeah, you probably could.
I'll play any card I got.
Well, I think she's in a unique position to... help us muggles to a certain extent understand what Tom is doing.
In the current projects.
I guess it's going back 5, 6, 8 years or something, maybe longer than that.
Mm.
You know, I think it's, I think she probably is in a unique situation to be able to give insight into what Tom was doing scientifically. In a way that I don't think many other people can. I think that's very special.
Oh, wow.
It's the,
yeah, I think you're right.
So, you know, I met her briefly. You know, Tom would talk about her over the years. And, you know, Tom was not always easy to understand.
I had that story earlier, yes.
We'll have that story again, yes.
And he introduces me to Heidi, and it was sort of like, and now it's like a year and a half later, and I'm going back and understanding kind of what that connection is in a way. And I think that that's also so much, you know, there's the people around Tom, those who came close to, you know, who had a sense of what he was about and could, I wouldn't say, it wasn't a conversation. It was, there was a, when you got on the right plane with Tom, you know, and could kind of travel with him, it was just wonderful. And it's one of the really incredible things is his passing is to kind of discover this community of his friends that I kind of knew about kind of in very vague ways, and it's sort of like good people. There's good people here, and I think one of the best things to do in his memory is to, you know, this Tinkerbell effect. You know, it's like we all, you know, took away something from Tom, or it wasn't taking from him as much as what we all grew because of knowing Tom to a certain extent. And now being able to sort of hear everybody and share in that a little bit is really quite wonderful. So that thank you guys for inviting me to this. This is really, you know, I needed this.
Absolutely. Very
and
welcome.
We needed
we're,
you
yeah,
here,
we're
too,
very
Flip.
Glad you're here.
Yeah, Phil.
And I'm just going to take this chance to let everybody know you are listening to WGXE, and the Thingularity radio program will continue rolling. Even though if you're listening on old-fashioned radio, it's going to flip on over.
On the wireless, sir?
That's right. It's going to flip on over to the next show, which I'm sure is quality programming.
I think Jack Benny's up next.
But if you want to keep listening to our nonsense, hit the website, wgxe.org, listen, Thingularity, and you'll be able to stay with us as we roll right through the hour, because this is the sign-off. We're not going to stop. We're just going to keep going.
That's right.
So you have to make it very clear when where the on-the-air thing goes off.
I will begin swearing like a
sailor. Is Phil going to start dropping fifth bombs too?
No.
Because Joe will. Oh, man. You're right. You know, like, you mentioned that earlier about, like, you were talking about your when we talked last week, doing the sound test, about that connecting with everybody. I was actually relating that story to my fiancé, and I was, like, saying, yeah, Phil, it's interesting meeting Phil or knowing Phil and knowing Tom because, yeah, Tom was very fire and intense, and you guys are these collaborators over the years there, and Phil is, like, this kind of, like, liminal jazz musician type. Well, Phil's like, yeah, sure, I invented motion capture, but I'm going to go over here and play with my circuits that generate stuff that I've been doing for 60 years and experiment with that rolling edge of that. But yeah, to see the connections in everyone that are related to it and see all the personalities converge and gyre is interesting.
And this kind of sharing ideas and the sparkles that happen kind of, you know, well, and the arguments. I mean, it's, I don't know anybody who really agreed with Tom.
You mean all the time, you know? Or just all?
Oh, no. Just, you know,
be hard pressed to find somebody who agrees with someone all the time.
Yeah, I had that epiphany like 2 days ago. I was thinking, what, Tom? I was like, oh, crap. He was like family because I was mad at him half the time.
Yep.
And it was totally okay. Like family because I'm mad at him half the time. Of course he was. That's the archetypal spin, and that's why we're in each other's lives, right?
Mm. And I described the relationship more like brotherhood.
Yeah.
It was
exactly.
So, you know, what's wonderful about radio, by the way, is that the radio audience doesn't have any picture of this guy.
Very, very visual. They Googled it long ago.
Probably, yeah.
Look at that sunset.
I don't know.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, one of the really marvelous things here also is, again, the circle. I mean, it's
the circle.
Greg, so like Rudy's work. I mean,
Rudy's work in this house. Oh my God!
I was going to ask about that because that's a really interesting.
In this house,
I knew. excuse me, I knew Rudy from New York City back in the '80s, and he and Hudson moved up here, and then Rudy built this house himself, and he had a whole holography lab on the ground floor.
Yeah. It's the only basement in New York State that probably has a floating concrete slab.
Yeah.
If you know what that is, you know that's crazy.
I'm curious, Bev, if you know how he found Rudy. Because that's a really interesting connection. And Tom loved Rudy.
Yeah, yes, he did.
The two of them were both geniuses at
yes.
a higher level.
I am not entirely sure of how they found each other. I know that it goes way back. I'm not sure entirely of that story.
For the radio audience or who are accessing this archive in the year 2100, Rudy Burkhout, in this house we're in right now, and that's what makes it a sacred space, was like the premier holography artists of the human species in the 20th century and made some amazing work.
There
like, I know things, about holography
there
for
are things
all
that
my life.
Rudy has done with holography that nobody has emulated since.
I've seen his retrospective at New Paltz like 6-7 years ago, and I've never seen a single bit of his work except for one thing that was in this house. Yeah. And I was like, ah, I know how it works. I'm like, how did he do this? That means he did like 8 exposures going in different directions of different colors. And how can you possibly do this? But you do it when you build a floating concrete slab in a basement that doesn't vibrate when a little car drives by.
Or two subway lines,
or whatever, when you're in the city.
Between 7th and 8th Avenue and
the city.
Yeah. Wow.
I helped him build the slab in that.
Wow.
Back in like 83, 84.
So this house is even the first time he's done it.
No.
Holography based on a photographic process.
And the thing that was so interesting about Rudy is he was never trained in physics or math. He figured it out all by himself and created the most brilliant... And the holograms with
they're amazing.
Depth of field.
They're amazing. Not just depth of field, but they're moving in 8 different directions sometimes. It's like, what the hell's going on here? Oh, my God.
The amazing thing that Tom and Rudy kind of share this language and understanding. You know,
yes, same language.
It was where I can appreciate it, but I don't understand it. That's the and there's this preciousness, you know, of like, how do we not lose this, you know, and that that really is a driver, you know. It's like when you find these creative geniuses, and there's a certain recognition in their lifetime, but to a certain extent there's a tremendous sense of what they have produced that we may not appreciate, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do we do what we can so that it is not lost, you know? That's the then again, it's kind of the Tinkerbell effect, you know. How do you, there's this sense of this very vibrant, you know, wonderful thing, and if we don't find a way of supporting it spiritually,
you know, yes,
it'll disappear and be lost, you know,
and financially.
So that's
you know, whole swaths of grants are being wiped off the map as we speak,
right?
And yeah, beautifully said, Phil.
To be
you know, it's yeah, it is trying times for sure. You know, that's the, you know, it's and you know, Tom's spirit would have not done well.
He was happy to check out at this moment in time.
I was going to say, he got that impression. Very much expressed his displeasure.
In this circle, we got that impression.
What was going on. So he just didn't want to even listen. You know, he was an avid listener of the news and stuff, and he just tuned out. He just couldn't.
It's intense. It.
So,
but I like that we have this conversation, this circle, because it's, you're right.
And harken back to something you'd said, Phil, not losing that sort of that energy, the spark of the creative genius and the output.
Yeah, yeah.
The output of the genius. Like, Tom was very concerned about legacy.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something he and I would talk about often.
But what also is completely wonderful is and I have this on a whole bunch of different fronts also, which is, in a way, when you appreciate legacy, but also understand how legacy fuels future creativity. So there's another wonderful image. You know, I'm off in the Pacific Northwest seeing the rainforest, and there's a wonderful thing about what a seed log is, and it sends shivers down my back, right? So you see the redwoods, and at the base of the redwoods are these holes, right, that you drive through, walk through, and there's like this emptiness at the base of these monumental, you know, living things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what those came from is like, when the tree falls over, a sprout comes, and what you're seeing, that void at the bottom of the tree, was this where the seed log was that tree grew from, and there's this regeneration, and it's sort of like, okay, seed logs, here we go. You know, that's the
seed logs,
the sense of regeneration, you know, and that's the, you know, and how to,